3. All that night, with its almost grotesque incidents and the terrible denouement that followed in the early morning, still seems to me like a hideous nightmare, and is, for me at least, the most painful chapter in my chronicle. I was late for the ball, and it was destined to end so quickly that I arrived not long before it was over. It was 11 o'clock when I reached the entrance of the Marshal's house, where the same white hall in which the matinee had taken place had, in spite of the short interval between, been cleared and made ready to serve as the chief ballroom for the whole town, as we expected, to dance in. But far as I had been that morning from expecting the ball to be a success, I had had no presentiment of the full truth. Not one family of the higher circles appeared. Even the subordinate officials of rather more consequence were absent, and this was a very striking fact. As for ladies and girls, Pyotr Stepanovitch's arguments, the duplicity of which was obvious now, turned out to be utterly incorrect. Exceedingly few had come. To 4 men there was scarcely 1 lady, and what ladies they were! Regimental ladies of a sort, 3 doctors' wives with their daughters, 2 or 3 poor ladies from the country, the 7 daughters and the niece of the secretary, whom I have mentioned already, some wives of tradesmen, of post-office clerks, and other small fry. Was this what Yulia Mikhailovna expected? Half the tradespeople even were absent. As for the men, in spite of the complete absence of all persons of consequence, there was still a crowd of them, but they made a doubtful and suspicious impression. There were, of course, some quiet and respectful officers with their wives, some of the most docile fathers of families, like that secretary, for instance, the father of his 7 daughters. All these humble, insignificant people had come, as one of these gentlemen expressed it, because it was inevitable. But on the other hand, the mass of free and easy people, and the mass, too, of those whom Pyotr Stepanovitch and I had suspected of coming in without tickets, seemed even bigger than in the afternoon. So far they were all sitting in the refreshment bar, and had gone straight there on arriving, as though it were the meeting place they had agreed upon. So, at least, it seemed to me. The refreshment bar had been placed in a large room, the last of several opening out of one another. Here Prohorych was installed with all the attractions of the club cuisine and with a tempting display of drinks and dainties. I noticed several persons whose coats were almost in rags and whose get-up was altogether suspicious and utterly unsuitable for a ball. They had evidently been with great pains brought to a state of partial sobriety which would not last long, and goodness knows where they had been brought from. They were not local people. I knew, of course, that it was part of Yulia Mikhailovna's idea that the ball should be of the most democratic character, and that even working people and shopmen should not be excluded if anyone of that class chanced to pay for a ticket. She could bravely utter such words in her committee, with absolute security that none of the working people of our town, who all lived in extreme poverty, would dream of taking a ticket. But in spite of the democratic sentiments of the committee, I could hardly believe that such sinister-looking and shabby people could have been admitted in the regular way. But who could have admitted them, and with what object? Lyamshin and Liputin had already been deprived of their steward's rosettes, though they were present at the ball, as they were taking part in the literary quadrille. But, to my amazement, Liputin's place was taken by the divinity student, who had caused the greatest scandal at the matinee by his skirmish with Stepan Trofimovitch, and Lyamshin's was taken by Pyotr Stepanovitch himself. What was to be looked for under the circumstances? I tried to listen to the conversation. I was struck by the wildness of some ideas I heard expressed. It was maintained in one group, for instance, that Yulia Mikhailovna had arranged Liza's elopement with Stavrogin, and had been paid by the latter for doing so. Even the sum paid was mentioned. It was asserted that she had arranged the whole fete with a view to it, and that that was the reason why half the town had not turned up at the ball, and that Lembke himself was so upset about it that his mind had given way, and that, crazy as he was, she had got him in tow. There was a great deal of laughter, too, hoarse, wild, and significant. Everyone was criticizing the ball, too, with great severity, and abusing Yulia Mikhailovna without ceremony. In fact, it was disorderly, incoherent, drunken, and excited babble, so it was difficult to put it together and make anything of it. At the same time, there were simple-hearted people enjoying themselves at the refreshment bar, and there were even some ladies of the sort who are surprised and frightened at nothing, very genial and festive, chiefly military ladies with their husbands. They made parties at the little tables, were drinking tea, and were very merry. The refreshment bar made a snug refuge for almost half of the guests, yet in a little time all this mass of people must stream into the ballroom. It was horrible to think of it. Meanwhile, the prince had succeeded in arranging three skimpy quadrilles in the White Hall. The young ladies were dancing while their parents were enjoying watching them, but many of these respectable persons had already begun to think how they could, after giving their girls a treat, get off in good time before the trouble began. Absolutely everyone was convinced that it certainly would begin. It would be difficult for me to describe Yulia Mikhailovna's state of mind. I did not talk to her, though I went close up to her. She did not respond to the bow I made her on entering. She did not notice me. Really did not notice. There was a painful look in her face, and a contemptuous and haughty, though restless and agitated, expression in her eyes. She controlled herself with evident suffering. For whose sake? With what object? She certainly ought to have gone away, still more to have got her husband away. And she remained. From her face one could see that her eyes were fully opened, and that it was useless for her to expect anything more. She did not even summon Pyotr Stepanovich. He seemed to avoid her. I saw him in the refreshment room. He was extremely lively. But she remained at the ball and did not let Andrei Antonovich leave her side for a moment. Oh, up to the very last moment, even that morning, she would have repudiated any hint about his health with genuine indignation. But now her eyes were to be opened on this subject, too. As for me, I thought from the first glance that Andrei Antonovich looked worse than he had done in the morning. He seemed to be plunged into a sort of oblivion, and hardly to know where he was. Sometimes he looked about him with unexpected severity, at me, for instance, twice. Once he tried to say something. He began loudly and audibly, but did not finish the sentence, throwing a modest old clerk who happened to be near him almost into a panic. But even this humble section of the assembly held sullenly and timidly aloof from Yulia Mikhailovna, and at the same time turned upon her husband exceedingly strange glances, open and staring, quite out of keeping with their habitually submissive demeanour. Yes, that struck me, and I suddenly began to guess about Andrei Antonovich, Yulia Mikhailovna confessed to me afterwards. Yes, she was to blame again. Probably when, after my departure, she had settled with Pyotr Stepanovich that there should be a ball and that she should be present, she must have gone again into the study where Andrei Antonovich was sitting, utterly shattered by the matinee, must again have used all her fascinations to persuade him to come with her. But what misery she must have been in now! And yet she did not go away. Whether it was pride or simply she lost her head, I do not know. In spite of her haughtiness, she attempted, with smiles and humiliation, to enter into conversation with some ladies, but they were confused, confined themselves to distrustful monosyllables, yes and no, and evidently avoided her. The only person of undoubted consequence who was present at the ball was that distinguished general whom I have described already, the one who, after Stavrogin's duel with Gaganov, opened the door to public impatience at the marshal's wife. He walked with an air of dignity through the rooms, looked about and listened, and tried to appear as though he had come rather for the sake of observation than for the sake of enjoying himself. He ended by establishing himself beside Yulia Mikhailovna and not moving a step away from her, evidently trying to keep up her spirits and reassure her. He certainly was a most kind-hearted man of very high rank, and so old that even compassion from him was not wounding. But to admit to herself that this old gossip was venturing to pity her and almost to protect her, knowing that he was doing her honour by his presence, was very vexatious. The general stayed by her and never ceased chattering.
"They say a town can't go on without 7 righteous men. 7, I think it is. I'm not sure of the number fixed. I don't know how many of these 7, the certified righteous of the town, have the honour of being present at your ball. Yet in spite of their presence, I begin to feel unsafe. Vous me pardonnez, charmante ma'am, n'est-ce pas? I speak allegorically. But I went into the refreshment room, and I am glad I escaped alive. Our priceless Prohorich is not in his place there, and I believe his bar will be destroyed before morning. But I am laughing. I am only waiting to see what the literary quadrille is going to be like, and then home to bed. You must excuse a gouty old fellow. I go early to bed, and I would advise you, too, to go bye-bye, as they say, au enfant. I've come, you know, to have a look at the pretty girls, whom, of course, I could meet nowhere in such profusion as here. They all live beyond the river, and I don't drive out so far. There's a wife of an officer, in the Chasseur, I believe he is, who is distinctly pretty, distinctly, and she knows it herself. I've talked to the sly puss. She is a sprightly one, and the girls, too, are fresh-looking. But that's all. There's nothing but freshness. Still, it's a pleasure to look at them. There are some rosebuds, but their lips are thick. As a rule, there's an irregularity about female beauty in Russia, and they are a little like buns. Vous me pardonnez, n'est-ce pas? With good eyes, however, laughing eyes. These rosebuds are charming for 2 years when they are young, even for 3. Then they broaden out and are spoiled forever, producing in their husbands that deplorable indifference which does so much to promote the woman movement. That is, if I understand it correctly. It's a fine hall. The rooms are not badly decorated. It might be worse. The music might be much worse. I don't say it ought to have been. What makes a bad impression is that there are so few ladies. I say nothing about the dresses. It's bad that that chap in the grey trousers should dare to dance the can-can so openly. I can forgive him if he does it in the gaiety of his heart, and since he is the local chemist. Still, 11 o'clock is a bit early, even for chemists. There were 2 fellows fighting in the refreshment bar, and they weren't turned out. At 11 o'clock, people ought to be turned out for fighting, whatever the standard of manners. 3 o'clock is a different matter. Then one has to make concessions to public opinion. If only this ball survives till 3 o'clock. Varvara Petrovna has not kept her word, though, and hasn't sent flowers. She has no thoughts for flowers. Pauvre mère. And poor Lisa, have you heard? They say it's a mysterious story. And Stavrogin is to the front again. I would have gone home to bed. I can hardly keep my eyes open. But when is this literary quadrille coming on?
At last, the literary quadrille began. Whatever of late there had been conversation in the town on the ball, it had invariably turned on this literary quadrille, and as no one could imagine what it would be like, it aroused extraordinary curiosity. Nothing could be more unfavourable to its chance of success, and great was the disappointment. The side doors of the White Hall were thrown open, and several masked figures appeared. The public surrounded them eagerly. All the occupants of the refreshment bar trooped to the last man into the hall. The masked figures took their places for the dance. I succeeded in making my way to the front, and installed myself just behind Yulia Mikhailovna, von Lembke, and the general. At this point, Pyotr Stepanovich, who had kept away till that time, skipped up to Yulia Mikhailovna.
"I've been in the refreshment room all this time, watching,"
he whispered, with the air of a guilty schoolboy, which he, however, assumed on purpose to irritate her even more. She turned crimson with anger.
"You might give up trying to deceive me now, at least, insolent man,"
broke from her, almost aloud, so that it was heard by other people. Pyotr Stepanovich skipped away, extremely well satisfied with himself. It would be difficult to imagine a more pitiful, vulgar, dull and insipid allegory than this literary quadrille. Nothing could be imagined less appropriate to our local society, yet they say it was Karamazinov's idea. It was Liputin, indeed, who arranged it, with the help of the lame teacher who had been at the meeting at Virginsky's. But Karamazinov had given the idea, and had, it was said, meant to dress up and to take a special and prominent part in it. The quadrille was made up of six couples of masked figures who were not in fancy dress exactly, for their clothes were like everyone else's. Thus, for instance, one short and elderly gentleman wearing a dress coat, in fact, dressed like everyone, wore a venerable grey beard tied on, and this constituted his disguise. As he danced, he pounded up and down, taking tiny and rapid steps on the same spot with a stolid expression of countenance. He gave vent to sounds in a subdued but husky bass, and this huskiness was meant to suggest one of the well-known papers. Opposite this figure danced two giants, X and Z, and these letters were pinned on their coats, but what the letters meant remained unexplained. Honest Russian thought was represented by a middle-aged gentleman in spectacles, dress coat and gloves, and wearing fetters, real fetters. Under his arm he had a portfolio containing papers relating to some case. To convince the sceptical, a letter from abroad testifying to the honesty of honest Russian thought peeped out of his pocket. All this was explained by the stewards, as the letter which peeped out of his pocket could not be read. Honest Russian thought had his right hand raised, and in it held a glass, as though he wanted to propose a toast. In line with him, on each side, tripped a crop-headed nihilist girl, while vis-à-vis danced another elderly gentleman in a dress coat, with a heavy cudgel in his hand. He was meant to represent a formidable periodical, not a Petersburg one, and seemed to be saying, "I'll pound you to a jelly." But in spite of his cudgel, he could not bear the spectacles of honest Russian thought fixed upon him, and tried to look away. And when he did the pas de deux, he twisted, turned, and did not know what to do with himself. So terrible, probably, were the stings of his conscience. I don't remember all the absurd tricks they played, however. It was all in the same style, so that I felt at last painfully ashamed. And this same expression, as it were, of shame was reflected in the whole public, even on the most sullen figures that had come out of the refreshment room. For some time all were silent and gazed with angry perplexity. When a man is ashamed, he generally begins to get angry and is disposed to be cynical. By degrees, a murmur arose in the audience. "What is the meaning of it?" a man who had come in from the refreshment room muttered in one of the groups. "It's silly. It's something literary. It's a criticism of the voice. What's that to me?" From another group, "Asses." "No, they are not asses. It's we who are the asses. Why are you an ass?" "I am not an ass." "Well, if you are not, I am certainly not." From a third group, "We ought to give them a good smacking and send them flying. Pull down the hall." From a fourth group, "I wonder the Lempkas are not ashamed to look on. Why should they be ashamed? You are not." "Yes, I am ashamed, and he is the governor. And you are a pig." "I've never seen such a commonplace ball in all my life," a lady observed viciously, quite close to Yulia Mikhailovna, obviously with the intention of being overheard. She was a stout lady of 40, with rouge on her cheeks, wearing a bright-coloured silk dress. Almost everyone in the town knew her, but no one received her. She was the widow of a civil councillor, who had left her a wooden house and a small pension. But she lived well and kept horses. 2 months previously, she had called on Yulia Mikhailovna, but the latter had not received her. That might have been foreseen, she added, looking insolently into Yulia Mikhailovna's face. If you could foresee it, why did you come? Yulia Mikhailovna could not resist saying. Because I was too simple, the sprightly lady answered instantly, up in arms and eager for the fray. But the general intervened.
Chère dame, he bent over to Yulia Mikhailovna, you'd really better be going. We are only in their way, and they'll enjoy themselves thoroughly without us. You've done your part. You've opened the ball. Now leave them in peace. And Andrei Antonovitch doesn't seem to be feeling quite satisfactorily. To avoid trouble.
But it was too late. All through the quadrille, Andrei Antonovitch gazed at the dancers with a sort of angry perplexity, and when he heard the comments of the audience, he began looking about him uneasily. Then, for the first time, he caught sight of some of the persons who had come from the refreshment room. There was an expression of extreme wonder in his face. Suddenly, there was a loud roar of laughter at the caper that was cut in the quadrille. The editor of the menacing periodical, not a Petersburg one, who was dancing with the cudgel in his hands, felt utterly unable to endure the spectacled gaze of honest Russian thought, and, not knowing how to escape it, suddenly in the last figure, advanced to meet him, standing on his head, which was meant, by the way, to typify the continual turning upside down of common sense by the menacing non-Petersburg Gazette. As Lyamshin was the only one who could walk standing on his head, he had undertaken to represent the editor with the cudgel. Yulia Mikhailovna had had no idea that anyone was going to walk on his head. "They concealed that from me. They concealed it," she repeated to me afterwards in despair and indignation. The laughter from the crowd was, of course, provoked not by the allegory, which interested no one, but simply by a man's walking on his head in a swallowtail coat. Lempke flew into a rage and shook with fury.
"Rascal!" he cried, pointing to Lyamshin. "Take hold of the scoundrel! Turn him over! Turn his legs, his head, so that his head's up! Up!"
Lyamshin jumped onto his feet. The laughter grew louder.
"Turn out all the scoundrels who are laughing!" Lempke prescribed suddenly.
There was an angry roar and laughter in the crowd.
"You can't do that, Your Excellency! You mustn't abuse the public. You're a fool yourself," a voice cried suddenly from the corner. "Filibusters!" shouted someone from the other end of the room.
Lempke looked round quickly at the shout and turned pale. A vacant smile came onto his lips, as though he suddenly understood and remembered something.
"Gentlemen,"
said Yulia Mikhailovna, addressing the crowd which was pressing round them, as she drew her husband away.
"Gentlemen, excuse Andrei Antonovitch. Andrei Antonovitch is unwell. Forgive him, gentlemen."
I positively heard her say, "Forgive him." It all happened very quickly. But I remember for a fact that a section of the public rushed out of the hall immediately after those words of Yulia Mikhailovna's, as though panic-stricken. I remember one hysterical, tearful, feminine shriek.
"Ah, the same thing again!"
And in the retreat of the guests, which was almost becoming a crush, another bomb exploded, exactly as in the afternoon.
"Fire! All the Riverside Quarter is on fire!"
I don't remember where this terrible cry rose first, whether it was first raised in the hall, or whether someone ran upstairs from the entry, but it was followed by such alarm that I can't attempt to describe it. More than half the guests at the ball came from the quarter beyond the river, and were owners or occupiers of wooden houses in that district. They rushed to the windows, pulled back the curtains in a flash, and tore down the blinds. The riverside was in flames. The fire, it is true, was only beginning, but it was in flames in three separate places, and that was what was alarming.
"Arson! The Spigulin men!" roared the crowd.
I remember some very characteristic exclamations.
I've had a presentiment in my heart that there'd be arson. I've had a presentiment of it these last few days. The Spigolin men! The Spigolin men, no one else! We were all lured here on purpose to set fire to it.
This last most amazing exclamation came from a woman. It was an unintentional, voluntary shriek of a housewife whose goods were burning. Everyone rushed for the door. I won't describe the crush in the vestibule over sorting out cloaks, shawls, and pelisses. The shrieks of the frightened women, the weeping of the young ladies. I doubt whether there was any theft, but it was no wonder that in such disorder some went away without their wraps because they were unable to find them. And this grew into a legend with many additions, long preserved in the town. Lempke and Yulia Mikhailovna were almost crushed by the crowd at the doors.
"Stop, everyone! Don't let anyone out!"
yelled Lempke, stretching out his arms menacingly towards the crowding people.
"Everyone, without exception, to be strictly searched at once!"
A storm of violent oaths rose from the crowd.
"Andrei Antonovich! Andrei Antonovich!"
cried Yulia Mikhailovna in complete despair.
"Arrest her first!"
shouted her husband, pointing his finger at her threateningly.
"Search her first! The ball was arranged with a view to the fire!"
She screamed and fell into a swoon. Oh, there was no doubt of its being a real one. The general, the prince, and I rushed to her assistance. There were others, even among the ladies, who helped us at that difficult moment. We carried the unhappy woman out of this hell to her carriage, but she only regained consciousness as she reached the house, and her first utterance was about Andrei Antonovich again. With the destruction of all her fancies, the only thing left in her mind was Andrei Antonovich. They sent for a doctor. I remained with her for a whole hour. The prince did so too. The general, in an access of generous feeling, though he had been terribly scared, meant to remain all night by the bedside of the unhappy lady. But within 10 minutes he fell asleep in an armchair in the drawing-room while waiting for the doctor, and there we left him. The chief of the police, who had hurried from the ball to the fire, had succeeded in getting Andrei Antonovich out of the hall after us, and attempted to put him into Yulia Mikhailovna's carriage, trying all he could to persuade His Excellency to seek repose. But I don't know why he did not insist. Andrei Antonovich, of course, would not hear of repose, and was set on going to the fire, but that was not a sufficient reason. It ended in his taking him to the fire in his droshky. He told us afterwards that Lempke was gesticulating all the way and shouting orders that it was impossible to obey, owing to their unusualness. It was officially reported later on that His Excellency had at that time been in a delirious condition, owing to a sudden fright. There is no need to describe how the ball ended. A few dozen rowdy fellows, and with them some ladies, remained in the hall. There were no police present. They would not let the orchestra go and beat the musicians who attempted to leave. By morning they had pulled all Prohoritch's stall to pieces, had drunk themselves senseless, danced the Kamarinsky in its unexpurgated form, made the rooms in a shocking mess, and only towards daybreak part of this hopelessly drunken rabble reached the scene of the fire to make fresh disturbances there. The other part spent the night in the rooms dead drunk, with disastrous consequences to the velvet sofas and the floor. Next morning, at the earliest possibility, they were dragged out by their legs into the street. So ended the fate, for the benefit of the governesses of our province.